Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
The step that I get them to do is to begin asking questions. But here's the thing. We all know asking questions is a good thing, but we don't realize that we have to actually teach the kids how to ask questions. I know it sounds really silly, but if you take them to the table of contents and you say, let's turn this into a who, what, when, where, why, or how question, they all of a sudden have something that they can turn into a question about what they're about to read. So now they're engaged. They're starting to think about what they're going to be reading. And they've asked a question that as they're reading, they're going to be able to answer. So that's the next step. After they've created those questions, they actually are reading and then answering the question. Well, guess what? They've created a question that will definitely be in the book. And we write them down and we take notes as we're reading. And so they automatically are actively reading because of that. And I have just found like this one tiny little simple process has converted them from being that passive reader to an active reader, which you don't see that process being taught in school systems at all, but it's what we do in real life, right? So when we read a text, we're like, oh shoot, I totally don't remember that part, is I need to go back and read. Or, okay, I didn't understand that. I'm gonna have to go back and read that. Or, you know, when they're asking their questions and they're like, I don't know if that was answered.
There's like a critical engagement in the book, but also in their experience with the book.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Mortimer Adler and how to read a book?
Yep.
Yeah. Because it sounds like the first thing that you're describing is, I think he called it inspectional reading, right? Which is actually, you know, you're trying to determine if this is the right book for you. And I think one of the things that really kills active reading is not having the freedom to choose the books that you're reading.
Oh, 100%.
Everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is Wednesday, May 9th, and just a couple of things before we get started here. I am currently in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It is my first stop on, I guess, a move I would describe as School Sucks Down America. I'm leaving at 4 a.m. with a couple of my friends. We are driving from the Pittsburgh International Airport to New Orleans, Louisiana. This coming weekend, Renegade University and School Sucks Project present a weekend with Thaddeus Russell. If you're in, say, I don't know, a 200-mile radius, it's not too late for you to decide to attend. There are still tickets available. You can go to ThaddeusRussell.com/courses. And this is getting more exciting by the day. Adding special guests like Camille Foster, the things that we have to talk about while we're there. I'm thinking the podcast on Sunday has the potential to be an explosive ordeal. So yeah, I'm pretty enthusiastic about seeing some new parts of America and traveling with friends and, of course, this great weekend where I'm going to get to meet School Sucks listeners for the first time. And I'm pretty sure it's going to be awesome, just like the previous events have been awesome. And I've been doing a bit of school touring lately. I was at Carnegie Mellon University on Monday, and I got a chance to take a look at certain aspects of both their engineering and robotics programs because robots are the future. Folks, we all know this. And with all sincerity, I felt compelled after my visit to temper some of my previous comments and topics of entire shows, I guess, about higher education. There are still ways, obviously, to invest wisely in college. And I thought Carnegie Mellon, based on what I saw, was a great example of that. And of course, there are many others. And another really cool thing that I saw there was this scoreboard thing that was set up in one of the quads, and it just said, capitalism works for me. And there was a little digital panel on one side for true and another digital panel on the other side for false. And it was off, so I didn't get to see what the tally was. But it's really cool that there are still higher education settings where the idea of capitalism can actually produce a discussion or debate instead of just screaming and tears. And then yesterday, I was at a boarding school out in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania. I went with my friend who works in educational technology to install some training equipment, vocational training equipment. And oh man, it certainly jogged my memory in some very vivid ways about my experience working in a place like that. So that was an interesting day. Afterwards, we happened across the Frank Lloyd Wright House, Falling Water, which is even more in the middle of nowhere. The house was actually commissioned in the 1930s by the Kaufman family. The Kaufmans were, oh, this is interesting. We're actually transitioning from the legacy of one wealthy Pittsburgher, Andrew Carnegie and Carnegie Mellon. I think the Mellon was Thornton Mellon, who actually enrolled in the school to help his son, who was a freshman and he was struggling. So he, you know, went there as an older, already successful man and somehow got his name in the name of the school. I might be confusing that with the 1986 Rodney Dangerfield movie, Back to School. This could be another Mellon. But let's transition from Andrew Carnegie to the Kaufman family. They were from Pittsburgh. They made a lot of their money in retail. And in the 1930s, they commissioned Wright to build them a rustic cabin by this beautiful waterfall, as I already said, like in the middle of absolutely nowhere. Wright didn't care about the desires of the people who commissioned him to build. So he said, no, you're not getting a rustic cabin near a waterfall. You're getting an architectural masterpiece on a waterfall. And I think we're all beneficiaries today of his obstinance there. The budget, that house, which is, you know, a national architectural landmark, it was built for $140,000, I think, in 1936. That translates maybe to like $4 million today. And that's because between now and then, the government's had kind of a money printing problem. But the really astonishing fact is that $140,000 was $110,000 over the Kaufman's budget. But it was an absolutely amazing experience. We got to spend about an hour inside this truly magnificent architectural feat. And you can see my pictures of it, along with many other delights, on my Instagram. Just search Instagram for Brett Vinott or School Sucks Project and follow us there. Oh, and last thing, I want to do some quick shout-outs to everyone who has joined us on Patreon this week. Madeline, Cody, Russell, John, and Skirmantis, thank you so much. These are people who now know how the last podcast with Thad actually ended. So I hope you guys enjoyed that. Anyway, I'm excited to present today's show to you. My guest is Joanne Kaminsky. She is about my age. She has a kind of similar background, including the fact that she started her tutoring career, private tutoring, around the same time I did. But she took a very different approach, and we're going to talk about that on the show today. She's, in addition to being the mother of three girls, a former public school teacher, she now runs an online tutoring business called the Online Reading Tutor. And she also has a blog called Become an Online Tutor. You can check that out at becomeanonlinetutor.com, where she teaches people how to do what she does with success and serenity. So I know for a fact there are lots of dynamic and interesting and well self-educated people in this audience. If you're looking to turn all of those fine attributes into an additional stream of income, definitely check out Joanne's blog. And I know there's a lot of people in the audience who send their kids to public school and are generally unsatisfied with that experience, which hopefully makes this show a less frustrating engagement for you. And you're trying to either, I don't want to say supplement what's being taught in public school, but encourage reading in spite of school. I think there's going to be a lot of good information in this show for you today. And also, I have received questions about reading progress from home educating parents. You might remember that before I did this podcast, I was a special education teacher for a while. I am familiar in practice in the Orton-Gillingham methods of teaching reading. And I've had a few private, mostly private, I think, conversations. We've probably touched on this in the show here and there in the past. But parents say, you know, just for example, I have a son or a daughter who's 7 years old. This is where they're at. Is that a problem? Should I be concerned? I think today's show will be helpful. If your specific questions are not answered, I will definitely invite Joanne back in the near future to address specific listener questions. But we will definitely cover motivation, kind of mitigating the damaging effects that school can have on interest in reading, and how to lay the foundation for a life of active and critical reading. That will all be in the show today. And also, it's likely that we're introducing a lot of new people to School Sucks with this show because Joanne has a huge following. She's built a really impressive online network. And you will hear me mention the name John Taylor Gatto in our conversation today. John is a former public school teacher, a celebrated public school teacher, taught in New York for 30 years, won the Teacher of the Year Award 3 times. I might say 2 in the show, but I think it was actually 3. And went on to become a very, very powerful critic of the politics and the pedagogy of the system, but perhaps also the best educator on what I'm going to call the dark history of public school. It's really, really compelling stuff. And if you have questions about any aspect of school, it's definitely worth checking out his work. I'm dropping a link in the show notes, but I'll also give it to you here. SchoolSucksProject.com/Gatto. is basically an introduction to John and his book, The Underground History of American Education. And it includes a playlist, not a huge time commitment. You could just take it a video at a time. It's a playlist that I made based on that book between 2013 and 2015. So I encourage you to take the time and educate yourself about the history and politics and pedagogy problems when it comes to these public schools. And I want to thank one of the people that I brought on to do some writing at SchoolSucksProject.com. His name's John McLean, and he has recently been working on making that page as enjoyable as possible. After the, you know, initial period of shock and anger that comes with being red-pilled on any subject, I think you'll be glad you did it. So the link again is SchoolSucksProject.com/Gatto. If you own a cat and you speak Spanish, you already know that word, G-A-T-T-O. So if you are new, thank you so much for taking the time to check out this podcast. And if you are a regular listener, I will be checking in with you from the road over the next 4 or 5 days. So Instagram and the Facebook group are the places where you can see those updates. All right, everyone, then here I go. Bye. And here's the show. I hope you're having a great week, and I will talk to you again very soon. Take care. Hi, Joanne. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm really honored to be here.
So I wanted to talk first about your path. I'm always interested in the story and more specifically the school experience of anyone who becomes a public school teacher. It was something that I wanted to do at one point. I hated school when I was in it. But what was school like for you, and was that influential in your decision to want to pursue teaching as a career?
Oh, absolutely. So I actually always wanted to be a lawyer, I thought. And so I actually struggled with school. I was definitely a struggling reader, and I wasn't able to in middle school take the foreign language because I needed to take a reading class. And, you know, it was frustrating because I wasn't understanding what I was reading. And then finally, a teacher had actually, sat down with my mom and said, here are some things you can do with your daughter. And my mom listened, and we began reading together every single night. And we began reading Anne of Green Gables. And it wasn't until I sat down with my mom, we began reading that book together, that I could actually see exactly what was happening in that book. Like, I could see Anne like going down the path when she was going to the Cuthbert's house. And it really opened up my mind at that point. And I always had this like inner calling that like reading was going to be the thing that I was going to have a part in. And I had no idea how or why. I wasn't that great of a student in middle school, but come high school, I ended up graduating 10th in my class, got into Marquette University, Went for my master's, and I ended up getting a 4.0 when I was getting my master's. So that little struggle, that little hiccup that I had, it kind of followed me on my journey, because I was like, you know, I really want to help other kids with this. And when the path of not becoming a lawyer opened up for me, and I was like, this is not what I feel like is my calling, I started thinking back to, what am I good at? Mm. And then the idea of, I need to be a teacher, really just like sunk into my heart. And so it was at that point I decided I'm going to become a teacher. And I went through, you know, my schooling to become a teacher, got into my very first teaching experience. And oh my gosh, it was a nightmare. It was a brand new startup school. And it was in the inner city in Milwaukee. And
like a charter?
It was a charter school. Yep. First year teacher. And do you know how many first year teachers there were? I think most of us.
Yeah.
All of the lead teachers had some experience, but the rest of us were all brand new teachers out of the gate. And that year we lost 50% of our staff by December.
Wow.
So it was an awful startup. I had, on the very first day of school, I had 28 kids walk into my classroom, and then they got a call that the 29th kid would be coming, and I didn't even have a desk for them. And then I got the call that the 30th kid was going to come in, and I still didn't have a desk for the 29th student. So where was I going to fit this 30th student? And I got a call, two more calls, saying that they were going to put more kids in my classroom. And I was in the teeniest, tiniest little classroom. Like, you couldn't even fit another desk in there. I don't even know how we squeezed it together. It was like, seriously, the desks were all touching each other.
Wow.
So that we could fit all of these kids inside of my classroom.
That doesn't seem like it's really conducive to learning.
It really wasn't.
So we're about the same age. We probably started our teaching careers around the same time. I'm guessing early last decade for you. What was that like then? Because I remember being in graduate school and charters where everyone was talking about them. It seemed like a real viable alternative at the time, but it sounds like it was really unpredictable. And I did understand even back then that there was a problem with retention because that whole sector was so volatile.
Yeah, it you know, it's interesting because I don't know how normal startups go for schools, but because usually schools are just kind of, they've just been around, you know, like that whole idea of a startup school was so foreign. And so I had nothing to even fall back on to know, is this a good situation or a bad situation? All I knew is I hated my situation. And you can imagine with the desks so close to each other, there was a lot of hitting. There was a lot of fighting. There was a lot of kids getting in fights every single day. It was a nightmare of an experience. I seriously felt like I was like in some kind of like jailhouse.
Well, hey, I can definitely identify with that. And I think there's a lot of people in the audience who can as well. What age was it?
A third grade.
You didn't stay there your entire classroom teaching career, did you?
Most of it I did.
Yeah. How many years?
So actually, I stayed there for 8 years.
Oh, wow.
And you know what? I wouldn't have stayed. At the end of my first year of teaching, my dad passed away. And I was so overcome with grief that I didn't even know how to go about getting a new job at that point. And I felt, you know what? Let me just stick out another year because I don't have the brain capacity to look for a new job. So I will stay here for another year, then I'll figure it out. And my second year, I took a course on classroom management and it changed my life. Oh, no, it was called anger management. It was not called anger management. And I really learned how to connect with these kiddos in such a special way that other teachers and the principal kept coming to me for additional ideas and help. And I really became pivotal in helping people and how to work with these kids and build relationships with them.
Tell me a little bit about that, because I think a lot of us remember it. I mean, I do certainly, as a kind of self-alienating experience and not really feeling connected to my peers. And certainly, last but not least at all, not feeling connected or in positive relationships with a lot of the adults, right? Because they are the enforcers of, you know, it's interesting. You talked about like, no one thinks about a school starting up, right? No one thinks about school, you know,
right.
It's just the thing that's always there. It's where the bus drops you off. Your parents went, your grandparents went. This is never unpacked. And it was all realized in retrospect, but just not having connected relationships the entire 12 years I spent there, I think was obviously something I saw the real opposite of when I started working with smaller groups and especially with kids one-on-one. Mm-hmm. But what was it that you think you learned there that made what you were doing so different from the other teachers, from probably the relationships that most kids have had with teachers throughout time, because they're just kind of going through the motions of what the environment enforces?
Exactly, exactly. And so, like, some of the things that I learned was, you know, when you to pick out those top three kids that are causing you the most problem, and every third day, like, pick them out as the kid that you're just going to spend 5 minutes with before you even start your day at the classroom. So in the hallway, just hang out with them and ask them some questions, get to know them, and just kind of joke around and have fun with them, and know that, you know, just build, take that time to build that relationship, and they will want to do everything for you, and they won't want to disappoint you, is what I kind of found out. Like, if you take the time to get to know them, like, I thought as a teacher that you automatically got respect.
Oh boy.
Yeah, I did. I know, I was one of those people, like, you're the teacher, I'm going to respect you, because that's how I was growing up, right? Yeah, I respected my teachers. And so I expected that back. And that was totally the wrong way to go about it. I needed to earn their respect before they could respect me.
Yeah.
And
oh,
so
absolutely.
That was a real aha moment for me. And with a teacher's gosh, I wish I knew today. And I could, like, relive my entire experience working with teachers, because I did get promoted as the reading specialist. And so my job, I got to go into the classroom and evaluate how they taught reading and give them feedback.
Yeah. And you're making a face like that wasn't the most fun.
Oh, golly, no. Can you imagine? Like, all a teacher really wants to hear, all they want to hear is, you are doing an awesome job. Keep it up.
Oh, yeah. Especially with all the pressures and frustrations that they have to deal with, too. Yeah,
last
of course.
Thing they want to hear is how they can get better. It's the last thing they want to hear.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, when I was getting certified and I was getting my master's at the same time, and I've told this story on my show before, but all the people in the master's level classes with me were already teaching in public schools in Massachusetts and New York, which really weren't at that time. Maybe it's still the case, friendly to the teachers. Because of, you know, standardized testing, and it was right in the middle of No Child Left Behind. And they talked about, in the state of New York, inspectors coming into their classroom quietly. You weren't supposed to acknowledge them. Somebody would walk into your classroom and stand there with a clipboard and walk out. I mean, that would be a really, really discouraging thing, I think, for a lot of teachers.
Yeah. Oh, and that was my job. Like, with Edison, it was with Edison Schools. And so Edison Schools actually had a checklist of things that I was supposed to look for inside of their classroom. Teaching practices, were they using their walls to teach? What things were they doing? And I was like to check the box and then give them feedback. It was an awful experience.
Absolutely. So I want to talk a little bit about why you decided to leave. I know you said you listened to some of the podcast, and it's obviously called School Sucks. What we really talk about is education, right?
Yeah, so
that's the direction I definitely want to move this conversation in. And what you did next, I think, is definitely a much better example than what a lot of us got to do as teachers. So why did you leave classroom teaching when you did?
I got pregnant. And so that's why I ended up first leaving classroom teaching. And then my school promoted me to the reading specialist position. And since I absolutely loved reading, I thought that was going to be a really great fit. And it felt really good and comfortable for the first few years. And we continue to get a 50% turnover of our teachers every single year. And so only 30% of our kids were reading on grade level. And I felt, as somebody who was trying to move the progress forward with our kids, I really didn't either have the tools or knowledge, or I was put in a circumstance that I had no idea how to change, because they were always struggling with classroom management, just like I was in my first year of teaching.
Sure.
Lots of my time got spent with the classroom management side versus best teaching practices. And so I'm like, if I can't ever move forward with this, because I'm stuck in this cycle of having to help them with classroom management, which I want to help them so they can build those relationships with those students. But we can't move reading forward without reading conversations. And so I decided to go to a different school. So I left for 1 year and I went to a school that 90% of the kids were reading on grade level. And I found that the politics was absolutely horrible. We really didn't have that kind of politics at the charter school that I was going to.
What do you mean specifically?
Oh gosh. So some of the teachers had a weird relationship with the principal, and if they felt like they were in competition of who was in, like, who was the favorite in the principal's eyes.
Oh, yikes.
And I really hadn't experienced that before. I had some older teachers that absolutely refused to go to any professional development and would call in sick on the day that they were supposed to have their professional development. And I'm like, what is this?
Sure.
Because they refused to get the professional development. And then I had, I was getting watched. So I was having, like, when I was having my professional development with the teachers, I was actually having people from the, so because we're such a big district, I would have my boss for the reading side of things coming on in to my professional development and watching me. And, it was a very weird experience, but she never told me she was actually watching me. She was like, I'm just here to hang out with you guys. And I'm like, sure. So I tried to make her feel comfortable, like one of the team and all of that. And then later she's like, I was here to observe you. I'm thinking that probably should have been stated before.
Well, I don't know. Actually, maybe that had an unexpected benefit, right?
Oh, golly.
It's creepy after the fact, but sure.
No, it was very creepy. And what had happened was I was in and out of the school system that year because I was ill. So I had a pain in my side that actually was making me go to the hospital. I was probably at the hospital 2 or 3 times a week because of this pain. And I think it was stress related. It's hard for me to know if it was stress related or not. But it was 6 months of not knowing why my body was doing this. So I'd wake up, I'd feel okay. I'd start walking around and this pain would develop in my side, and when it would get worse and worse and worse as the day went on. And then by the end of the day, I could hardly walk. I'm like, this is not normal. I don't know what's going on. Like, my body is shutting down. But the weird thing is I would wake up the next day and I'd feel okay. And then the pain would start slowly increasing as the day went on. And it was like that movie Groundhog's Day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, he wakes up and it's like the same day over again. And it was like, for me, it was the same pain being lived over again. I did take a 3-month leave of absence to just focus on my health and figure out what the heck is going on. When this lady actually came to visit me, it was right after I had come back and she had an ulterior motive. So it was disheartening, and it didn't make me feel like I was in the right place. You know, I remember getting back to school the next day. I sat down at my desk and I said, I just heard this voice just speak to my head, and it said, you were not meant to be here.
After you had been told that for so long, you felt, right? Or you'd been telling yourself that for so long.
Yeah, I had been telling myself that for a little while, that, you know, I wasn't even sure when I went to this new school if I did want to continue doing being a reading specialist, because I didn't like giving teachers feedback.
Right. Yeah, sure.
I hated it so much. And the thought, like, I have, even though I have a very like extroverted personality, I'm very introverted. And so I have like these huge fears to talk to people and tell them what they need to improve on and have these uncomfortable conversations. I absolutely hate it. I'd rather just tell them all the things that they're doing great and keep up the great work. I would love to do that, but that wasn't my job. And so that
was a trick too, because it's like, you know, a good friend, which I understand that's not the relationship, but a good friend is somebody who tells you what you need to hear, you know, what will help you. But the criticism would really hit me, especially when it would come from superiors, because so many aspects of the job. I mean, I worked with a similar population, a lot of kids who had social and emotional issues. It was a boarding school where I was teaching. Those kids had come from the inner city or like really poor rural parts of states like Vermont. The days were stressful, right?
Yeah.
And so it was like the sensitivity to criticism that wasn't presented in a constructive way or didn't start with like, hey, look, not that you're not doing an amazing job, right? But just this one thing, and it almost doesn't matter because you're so amazing. I mean, it's like you really feel like you need to hear that, but
delivering the criticism, the constructive criticism, is also so important if people want to do better, you know? So that's
exactly
the trick.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it is a trick. And, you know, now that I'm an online tutor business coach, I have learned how to do it the right way. And that's why I say I wish that I had the skills that I have today to be able to help those teachers, because I could have made such a bigger impact on them versus how I went about it.
Well, I mean, the environment's probably better for that, too. If you're working with people who are starting their own business, they're very self-directed, right?
Yes, where, the motivation is there, right?
Yeah, and in school, I think a lot of people have the experience where the job or the career or the mission is idealized, right? Mm-hmm. And then you get there and you realize that the truth is... Oh, wait a minute. In my case anyway, I was like, what was I thinking? I hated this for the last 12 years I had to spend in this place.
Right.
And I didn't hate it, but I saw a lot of the same frustrations and limitations in doing it. So, sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, the thing is, like, when you're trying to teach somebody something that is, you know how many credits we had to get in order to teach reading, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
6 credits. We don't leave college knowing how to teach these things. And so when it comes down deep down into it, like, you kind of just get like this, like, you kind of go through like the basics, but until you start teaching, you're not really able to apply. And so now that you're able to put both parts, now you have the experience and now you're applying the concepts or you're revisiting some of these concepts, you know, there's definitely going to be areas of improvement that need to be made. And, you know, we all have to be mindful on how to speak to people. And it was sad. I think in the whole coaching thing, when it came to like teachers going on in and coaching other teachers, there was zero help on how to do that. There was no education training for us as coaches. It was just, here's your job now. This is what you're going to do. And so when you don't have any training in how to do something, obviously you're going to stink at it. So I pretty much think I stunk at it.
Sure. So how did you make this transition to online work? And I guess, where did you get the confidence after kind of a frustrating decade in the school system to think you could do this? Because you started doing this like 2010, right?
I did, a pioneer. Yeah.
It's funny. The name of your company, the Online Reading Tutor, suggests that you were pretty much the first, you know.
That's right. That's right. One of the first. And I actually started off as the Skyping reading tutor.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Then I started realizing, oh, nobody's typing in Skyping. So I became the Skype reading tutor. And then I realized, well, I'm not using Skype anymore. I'm using Zoom. So I'm just going to call myself the Online Reading Tutor.
Right.
So it kind of morphed over time. But I actually tried 5 other businesses before I even started the online tutoring. And I really thought that I just needed to do something different when I left the school system. And it wasn't until trying those 5 other businesses and failing at them that I realized, but teaching is your passion. Why would you be doing anything else? And it was in that moment that I realized, oh my gosh, I could use Skype to tutor online. So I started looking online to see, like, who's hiring online reading tutors. There have to be people that are hiring reading tutors, right?
Sure.
Because this is huge. Like, lots of kids struggle with reading, and I wasn't able to find one. So they had math tutors, they had SAT tutors, ACT tutors. I even saw writing tutors, but I didn't see anywhere that had reading tutors. Was all thrown under language arts. And I'm like, but I want to tutor reading. And that's all I want to tutor. Like, I really want to focus on reading. And so I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do this on my own. I'm going to go solo. And I heard that Sylvan was charging like $50 an hour. So I was like, all right, I'll lowball him a little bit. I'll go $40 an hour.
Sure.
And I'll see what I get. I didn't even think I would pay $40 an hour for tutoring. Mm-hmm. So at that point in time, that was a big number for me to think $40 an hour. So I started contacting people, and my sister-in-law, I said, hey, you know what? I know that your son is struggling with reading, and I want to get comfortable with the technology side. Like, I obviously can do the reading part of it, but I want to get comfortable and see, is this even a viable business idea?
Right.
And She kind of gave me slack. She thought that her son was going to be a guinea pig. And I'm like, trust me, there's nothing about him being a guinea pig here, because all the strategies that I teach kids, I'm going to be teaching him. Like, it's not the reading strategies. It's just, I just need to know, does the technology work? Can he like read my screen? Can he read the books that I put in front of him? Can he do the activities that I do without me sitting like right next to him? Like, I felt like I needed this like verification that yes, it would work. And we soon found out not only does it work, but I can close the gap even quicker using the online format versus anything I've ever done before.
I found the same thing to be true. And I'll just tell the story as quickly as I can. I left the classroom in 2006 and started working as a tutor, academic and standardized testing from about 2006 to 2008 with one company, in 2009 to 2013 with my own company in New Hampshire. And the latter was almost entirely SAT tutoring and college consulting. Everything was in person. Like, you live in Wisconsin, so I don't know if you've ever driven in Massachusetts. It's one of the worst places to drive in the world.
Yes, I was born there.
I was commuting 600 miles a week in the greater Boston area. Right.
Oh.
So that was kind of souring my attitude about that as well. By the time I was running my own business, we were collecting kids into one place. We would set up a class at a school. We had like meeting centers that we would use. So it wasn't like, I mean, that was like the crazy time management thing. Just, you're here at 3 o'clock. I mean, I could maybe group some kids together at the library and just do like 3, 4, 5, 6, but it would be shooting from one place to another, you know, from Boston to Needham at rush hour. And it was
awful.
Yeah. I left the company, the second company, in 2013 because I was already about 4 years into doing the show and it was becoming a bigger time commitment. And then for a year, I coasted on word of mouth referrals from pretty much from one school district in central New Hampshire. So I couldn't drive anymore. I couldn't do it. I had moved out to the western part of the state by 2014. So I cut my rates by 40%. And I said, if you will do it on Skype, I will do it for, I was doing like 50 an hour in person. So it was like 30 an hour, just for the convenience of doing Skype, you know? So what I realized, regardless of what I was tutoring, even though a lot of it was SAT, is like, this is way more efficient. You know, I can send you a link. You have it. There's no trips to Staples. I mean, I feel like an old man talking about like, 6 years ago, I was in Staples. I was in Staples 3 hours a week making copies of things, you know? There's no more copies. There's a clear record, you know, of everything, like with a Skype chat, or I know Zoom does this too. There's a clear record of things. You can create that record of things that happen. It's super easy to share documents. You can know by sharing screens that the person's looking at the same thing that you're looking at. So there were just all these advantages that I thought would be obstacles. And then in the end, I was like, I didn't have to cut my rates. This is better, probably.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And in fact, I increased my rates because of it. As soon as I found out that this is better and I got myself booked solid, I'm like, that's it. I'm at 50 an hour. And then there, I was like, I'm 60 an hour. Now I'm all the way up to 75 an hour.
So, you know, it's interesting too. And I'd like to hear you. I know we said we'd move away from school, but there was a kind of revelation for me. And I think you probably share it about the efficiency of these different types of settings, you know? We spend 15,000 hours in public school, from grade 1 to grade 12. One of the most well-known and respected critics of the system, his name is John Taylor Gatto. I don't know if you're familiar. Definitely worth looking into. G-A-T-T-O. Yeah. He has a book called Against School, and he was, you know, he's not just some outsider criticizing the system. He spent 30 years in the schools in New York. He was the New York State Teacher of the Year twice, I think, and just one of the most connected and innovative educators, even though he was an old man at the time that he was doing it. He was a middle school teacher. You know, his approach to working with students and connecting them to the real world, it's just an amazing story. And, you know, I think his criticisms are really powerful as well. So, and his history of the system is really also very interesting. So he says that he was estimating kids would walk away from those 15,000 hours with about 80 instruction hours of functional skills. All right. So the first time I
worked with a girl, I think she was in middle school, on math. We did a year of curriculum in a month.
Wow.
Now, obviously, the advantage of one-on-one is, you know, that solves a problem. Not having, you know, being able to meet somebody maybe like the same number of hours a week, they'd be in math class, like two-hour sessions.
Mm-hmm.
But just the connection and the feedback that you get from working with somebody allows you to not just tailor things in a way that's going to make that boy or girl successful, but it also just really, once you're able to do that, increase the speed that you can just blow right through something like that. And I don't mean blow right through in a reckless and irresponsible way. I mean, like, really feel like you're making a lot of progress really quickly.
Right, because here's the biggest problem. The biggest problem is we are reteaching things to kids that they already know.
Mm, yeah.
So in my practice, the exact thing that I do is I skip that garbage. Look, if you know it, we're going to get rid of it and we're not going to come back to it unless we need to. But most of the time we don't need to because I already know it. So I'm able to skip all the stuff that they don't know and just focus on the things that they don't know and move them forward that much quicker because of it.
Sure. So what age are you working with mostly today?
Mostly it ends up being around like kids in like first through fifth grade. I've worked with kids as young as 3 years old. Mm. They already were starting to read and their parents really just wanted to like push them further, faster. And that was cool. And I've worked with kids in high school. I've worked with adults. It's not my passion. I have just found that I really enjoy working with the kids that you really can make a really great impact with very quickly. And so when they're in that first through like fifth grade range, I feel like I found my sweet spot there. Like I can close the gap for a kid. I can help them and they can be on their way.
Right.
One of the things I noticed in the school system is that a lot of the kids are not taught how to read nonfiction text. So I'm able to figure out pretty quickly, is this like, if they're struggling with comprehension, is that why they're struggling? Is because they don't know how to read the nonfiction text. And I've created a system to just be able to close it really quickly for them. And so, you know, if I can catch them in between that age range, they're golden for the rest of their educational success.
Let's tangent into that a little bit just for a minute. How to read nonfiction text, right? Because there's certainly a lot of evidence, I would say, in our society, and not to be a cynic, that people do not know how to do this, right?
Yes.
That people have a sort of uncritical approach to information. And as we see the online sort of infotainment world break into more and more disconnected kinds of echo chambers, we see that people who live in these echo chambers are starting to even have trouble interacting, you know, constructively with people in other echo chambers, right? So there's almost like a communication breakdown that is, as far as I'm concerned, kind of foreboding, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think it starts with an uncritical acceptance of a chosen form of information. And maybe that information confirms certain biases that people have. There's certain comforts that come with engaging with the same type of information, or certainly the same type of media personality over and over and over again, until they just get to places where they don't think there's any other way to see the world. So that's that problem pushed forward, starting from an uncritical approach to reading, I think, at a very young age.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just talk about that a little bit, working with nonfiction texts in an analytical and active way. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts about that.
Well, I've definitely found that the kids want to approach it the same way they approach fiction text, and they want to read it very passively, right? And so they're not actively engaged with it.
Mm.
So the first step that I get them to do is to begin asking questions. But here's the thing. We all know asking questions is a good thing, but we don't realize that we have to actually teach the kids how to ask questions. I know it sounds really silly, but if you take them to the table of contents and you say, let's turn this into a who, what, when, where, why, or how question, they all of a sudden have something that they can turn into a question about what they're about to read. So now they're engaged. They're starting to think about what they're going to be reading. And they've asked a question that as they're reading, they're going to be able to answer. So that's the next step. After they've created those questions, they actually are reading and then answering the question. Well, guess what? They've created a question that will definitely be in the book. And we write them down and we take notes as we're reading. And so they automatically are actively reading because of that. And I have just found like this one tiny little simple process has converted them from being that passive reader to an active reader. And then when they go to take the test at the end, they're able to remember more information from the book because they weren't reading it from beginning to end. While they were answering their questions, they had to go back and do some rereading if they didn't know the answer. So that they automatically are reading, rereading while they're doing their first read, which you don't see that process being taught in school systems at all, but it's what we do in real life, right? So when we read a text, we're like, oh, shoot, I totally don't remember that part. I need to go back and read. Or, okay, I didn't understand that. I'm going to have to go back and read that. Or, you know, when they're asking their questions and they're like, I don't know if that was answered. Well, let's think about it. Let's go back. Let's reread it. And if it didn't get answered, we'll keep reading on.
So that's,
you know, sometimes
nice.
Our questions get answered.
There's like a critical engagement in the book, but also in their experience with the book, right?
Exactly. Their questions. So they're more engaged to begin with.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Mortimer Adler and How to Read a Book?
Yep.
Yeah, because it sounds like the first thing that you're describing is, I think he called it inspectional reading, right? Which is actually, you know, you're trying to determine if this is the right book for you. And I think one of the things that really kills active reading is not having the freedom to choose the books that you're reading.
You know? 100%. Yeah, absolutely. And that's the cool thing online is I use, I don't know if you've heard it before, but it's Kids A to Z. And so I have like 30 books at every single guided reading level at my fingertips, and the kids can automatically choose. Now, if we're just working on nonfiction, I start off the conversation with, all right, you have 10 books here. Choose a nonfiction book you want to read. So now they have to automatically think, is this fiction or nonfiction?
Mm-hmm.
So they're automatically thinking about what those terms mean. And then they go through and they pick the one that they want to read. So again, they have that choice there because that's huge.
You ever organize it maybe by topic? Like, what are you interested in? Go find books?
I don't, not at this point, just because they need more guided structure at this point when I begin working with the kiddos versus kind of letting them go out and find the books. But I think that's a great next step for, you know, I do have the conversations with them of choosing books at their library and, you know, reading what they're engaged in. So we have those kinds of conversations. But my big main thing is being able to get them in text that is at their just right level. So many times these kids are put in text that's either too hard or too easy. And when that happens, they cannot, we learned this when we were in college, right? That it's the zone of proximal development, ZPD.
Mm-hmm. Right,
I really didn't have the ZPD moment until I started tutoring.
Sure.
Because it was in the moment of tutoring that I realized, oh my gosh, I learned about this in college. I am able to increase their level because I am right at their instructional level. So I find out ahead of time what I give, like a free assessment to find out what is their reading level so that I can teach at their instructional level so that I can push them further faster. I do teach them the five finger rule, that when they come to a text, that if they can't read five words on a page, then it's too hard for them. But most of the stuff, since I have the control and I know what's going to be right at their level, I can move them up the levels as I notice that their instructional level is increasing. I've never had to move kids down levels, which is good.
Right.
And the kids get really excited. It's almost like it turns it into a game when I move them up levels. So in Kids A to Z, the way it usually works is that they have to read all of the books in order to move up a level. And I thought, oh my gosh, let's talk about the slowest way to be able to increase someone's reading level.
Indeed,
and
right.
Also bore them, right? If I've got to read like 30 books at the D level or even at the age level before I can move on up, I'm killing their enthusiasm for reading.
Sure.
And so I'm able to say to them after they read some books on their own, because they have access to all of these books in between our sessions, and they read them on their own. We come back into the next session. I have them read a book. They get all the comprehension questions right. And I'm like, bam, you nailed it. Let's go up a level. And right. they get excited. I've turned it into like a video game for them.
Okay, so there's actually an interesting question, or it leads me to a new topic. If you, the grades and ages that you talk about working with, if the kids are already in elementary school or even, say, in high school, probably almost all the work you do is about addressing deficits that have been identified, right? It's sort of intervention.
Yeah.
You probably encounter lots of motivational problems and lots of negative attitudes that come from the experience of reading in school, or not to put all the blame on school, that come from maybe the more general experience of struggling with reading.
Yeah, so yeah, absolutely.
How do you actively address those things? I mean, it sounds like the methods that you use address those things or prevent those things, but if you if young people come into the situation with those things already being pretty persistent problems, how do you try to solve that?
Making it fun, you know, just like throwing my personality in there, having fun with them, engaging, goes back to building those relationships, right? And getting to know them and caring about them. And then at the same time, when they just being able to boost up their confidence, you know, and just be like, holy cow, do you remember when we first started working together, how hard that was? And that was like super easy for you just now. You know, like just having those kinds of compliments that they're not used to hearing, and somebody who's working with them one-on-one, it really means a lot to them when you're able to give that kind of feedback. And I always use data with my kids, and I guess that's because it was driven into me from school, but we look at the data. And so I'll use like fluency data. I'll be like, oh my gosh, look at that. On the first read, you got 40, but on that last read, you just got 120 words per minute. You nailed it. Look at that. You just got better. This is awesome. I love it. And they get excited. They're enthusiastic. And so it just it pushes them to want to do better, to continue to do better and better and better. Now, I do have some kids. They struggle with depression. I've got kids that struggle with dyslexia. And, you know, it does take a little bit longer when they have dyslexia to be able to close that gap, but it absolutely can be closed. I've got kids that have ADHD issues, right? So I get like the whole gamut of like the world out there.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I'm very familiar with that population. One problem exacerbates another, or in some cases causes other types of problems. Emotional challenges very, very much interfere with intellectual pursuits, that kind of a thing. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking before we started just about my own experience. I don't remember a setting for tutoring that was like frustrating, you know, in the ways that teaching was frustrating.
Oh, for sure.
You know, and then I just realized, oh, this is like a kind of normal human interaction that I'm having, even though it has a certain dynamic. And it took me with some kids, there was a process of like breaking down, you know, their expectation of like, oh, I get what you're all about, adult coming to do educational things with me, right? Like you're just like one of them at school. You know, nothing against the people who are at school. It's again, it's the environment and what that environment imposes on them. And then, you know, it kind of poisons the well towards any relationship like that. So I remember working to get over that with certain kids. But it usually happened really quickly. Like when I was a teacher, I thought I was super cool and edgy, and I would like lock up all the textbooks and be like, those books are dumb and 30 years old, and we're gonna watch YouTube because that's new. And the kids were just like, yeah, whatever. And if anything, I think they felt kind of uncomfortable about it because it's like, hey, man, this is school. Are you nuts? What are you doing? Like, I'm not, I don't like what the normal thing is, but at least I'm used to it. Right.
Right.
But
right.
The level of personalization and authenticity in like one-on-one interactions, it was so much more efficient and connected than like, God, what was I doing as a teacher? Writing IEPs.
Right.
Right? Individualized education programs where you just, I felt like that's identify the deficit, step one, and then you copy and paste prescriptions into like an Excel document and send it to somebody, you know?
Right. And then they never get followed through.
Like, and that's called personalized education, right? It isn't. Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. And the thing is, a lot of the teachers that were trying to help close these deficits didn't have any more education than us that were sitting in those classrooms, is what I realized over time. Like, they don't have the magic formula.
Right. Absolutely.
They don't actually have a magic formula. They're working with these kids and they don't have the magic formula. So I was supposed to send the kids that had dyslexia to a regular special ed teacher who didn't have any background knowledge in dyslexia.
Yeah.
Huh. Wow. There's something wrong with our educational system, is what I realized at that point. Like, there's, if we don't have the experts actually working with these kids, how are we ever going to close the gap? Like, we need somebody who knows how to specifically work with this learning disability and this learning disability, not put them all together in one room.
Well, yeah, and that's basically the opposite of what we're talking about as far as personalization, even though that passes as accommodations and modifications in the school, is grouping kids like that together in environments that are almost antagonistic towards maybe some of the issues that they're dealing with, especially, I mean, it was like a chemistry experiment in this one classroom that I had. The kids had a kind of unifying psychological issue around sexual abuse, survivors of sexual abuse. That was what brought them all to me. But the variety of emotional and behavioral issues they had, we would have to like strategize with the psychologist who helped me run the program and the behavior manager, he was called. We would have to have meetings about like, okay, so so-and-so is like this, and that triggers, and maybe we didn't have that word then, but that triggers this issue in this other kid, and then that creates this dynamic that affects this other kid. I mean, we were really having conversations like that. These kids didn't belong together. Not that I think anybody belongs in forced associations with each other, because that creates super negative social interactions, including bullying, but that was just the environment. And we didn't even, like what you're saying, to be able to get to the part where people are thinking about education, that would have been great. All we were doing was dealing with behavior, which is what you said at the very beginning of this discussion about the the charter schools. So I can totally, totally identify with that. But working with young people in what we both agree is a more ideal situation, I'm interested in just maybe some general outcomes as far as what you've learned about learning.
Yeah. So I have definitely learned that kind of like you had mentioned with Mortimer Adler is that we have a lot. Oh, no. Was it maybe it was John Gatto that you're talking about that has the there's so much wasted time in education. You know, the transitions between classes, I found that to be constantly like an issue because it would take so long to regroup students. There is no regrouping when I tutor online. I go from student to student to student. I don't even need a break in between my students. So if I tutor from 2 to 3, 3 o'clock, I can get my next student. And guess what? They're sitting right there and they're ready to go. There is zero transitional time that needs to happen.
Is it always an hour at a time per student?
No. So I do, because I do work with younger kids and I do work with kids with ADHD. I will determine it based off of the child's needs. Okay. So if they, if I find that I always figure it out during the assessment because the assessment's about an hour long. I'm watching them. Are they yawning? Are they fidgeting? Are, what are they doing while I'm doing the assessment? And I find out, okay, was 30 the number that they kind of got stuck at? Like after that, they stopped being able to really hang in there with me. Most of the kids are able to hang in there most of the time, but I do find if they're in first grade, if they're in kindergarten, they absolutely do not have that attention span. 30 minutes is the perfect amount for them. But then if they are second grade on up, I will base it off of their personal interaction with me in that assessment. So there are a few occasions where it needs to, definitely needs to be like 2 half-hour sessions during the week instead of an hour session.
Excellent. So since we are almost out of time, and I actually hope we could continue this conversation in the future because I bet there's a lot more we could talk about. So maybe we could just end with a preview of something else that I'd really like to talk. I mean, I think we could get into more detail about this part of the discussion, but I just wanted to ask you a couple questions about, you know, doing this as a business.
Yeah.
I remember, and I was prompted by you just saying you could go from one student to the next. I remember this is where I really started to become aware that I had issues with presence, like being in the place I'm supposed to be at the only time I can be there, which is right now. So because I would schedule like 3 kids in an afternoon from the time that school gets out until like I figure like 9 o'clock was pretty much the cutoff time. I remember feeling really bad, like sitting in a session and framing him, and in any moment of silence I'd be like, what is 495 gonna look like at 5:30, you know, like how am I gonna get to Haverhill by 7, you know, like those kinds of things. It's like I was always a step ahead of myself, and it would often disconnect me from being in the present. And I also realized that I kind of struggled with that time management aspect of it. I didn't like having a life that was just set up by blocks of time. So I would, just for my own, and I've worked a lot on this since then, but I'd just like to hear how you manage your time and your schedule.
Yeah. So I've got three kids and that can get, you know, pretty crazy, but I do have, like, as soon as I get my kids out the door, sometimes I have students from other countries. So I work with a kid in India at 8:30 after I drop my kids off at school, and it's his evening time on Friday. Mm-hmm. And then I have a couple of hours that are off where I can do like some side stuff, where I'm helping out the tutors, or I have coaching calls or that kind of stuff. And then I work with a couple of more students in the afternoon, and then I got a little bit more break time. So I can choose if I want to take a nap, which sometimes I do.
Right. Sure, I bet.
And that's actually really good, because then it gets me refreshed. And then I kind of have my big push from like 4 to 7 is usually where the push is. So then I still have a little bit of evening time that is available for my family and my kiddos. And we've really worked it out. Like, my husband in the beginning, I was still in charge of all the cooking and all of that. He now has taken over the cooking for the most part. And so it's a lot less stressful for me to figure out, how am I going to tutor and cook? Like, right. How do I get all that done? I've also found that whenever you're passionate about something, find out when is your best time to work. Like, my best time to work is in the morning. And so if I want to work on videos for my business, or if I want to work on any like advertising or anything like that, working on my website, any of those kinds of things, the best time for me to do that is when I first wake up in the morning. Like, I jump out of bed at like 5 o'clock in the morning, get my coffee, come downstairs, and I start like hashing away at that, because I know that I'm not going to be bothered by all the other things that kind of come at me, you know, emails about my students or teachers asking these questions or any of that kind of stuff. It's like, this is my time that I can just focus on this. And that's really pivotal to be able to block it out that way for yourself. But yeah, it is in the beginning, it kind of felt very interruptive, because I only had a few students here and there, and I based my time based off of when they could do tutoring.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Today, I base my tutoring off of when I'm available, and I decide when I'm available to do the tutoring. So I've made it a lot easier for myself, and I say, okay, these are the hours that I'll tutor, and I will not tutor outside of those hours unless, of course, I have a desire or a passion to work with that particular kid.
Awesome. Yeah, I was thinking about it, because I woke up this morning and I remember, like, so here's the leftover, right? I go, oh, I have an interview at 3, you know? And then it's like my whole day is like 3 o'clock, at 3 o'clock, you know, you have it. I mean, it's on a calendar. It's not like I'm obsessing about it, but it is interruptive is an interesting word. Now, it's not like I haven't had a fantastic time talking to you. I certainly have, but it's like that thing on my Google Calendar that is immovable. You know, and I'm real into like being on time.
Yes.
I realize this isn't super popular, but I'm always 5-10 minutes early for everything. Yeah. And like those things, they really just loom very large in my life. And I always felt like there was a healthier way to manage it. So that's why I wanted to just ask about how you do it, because I know it's just like one of those big hard blocks after another. So that's very interesting. So, hey, let's pick this up another time. There's more that we could talk about. I'd love to hear about your blog, but can you just tell my audience about first your business website and then your business coaching website?
Yes. So actually, we have a group on Facebook. It's called the Ultimate Support Group for Online Tutors. Everybody is welcome to come and join us there. It's a free Facebook group. And then I have a blog. It is called becomeanonlinetutor.com. And then I also have a YouTube page. So it's just youtube.com/JoanneKaminsky. And you'll find a ton of videos on how to get started with your online tutoring business.
That's awesome. I'll make sure it's all linked in the show notes for today's episode. And I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Awesome. I can't wait.
All right. I'll leave it there. I assume you do have to go at 4 o'clock.
So,
I would like to, like I said, pick your brain a little bit more about this. We'll connect in the near future and we'll go from there.
Sounds good.
I'll send you a link when this is up.
Awesome. And I will share it everywhere.
All right. Have a good day.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.
I like to eat apples and bananas. I like to apples and bananas.
Your turn.